Warning, the following podcast may contain descriptions that some listeners may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised. Any views are all our own and do not in any way reflect the places where we work.
Hello and welcome to Mad or Bad. My name is Rachel.
And I'm Neil.
And today we bring you the story of Air France Flight 447. On the night of May 31st, 2009, Air France 447, an Airbus A330-200, departed from Rio de Janeiro with its intention to arrive in Paris, France. This was set to be a 12-hour flight. A mere 4 hours later, the flight encountered expected icy conditions, as well as thunderstorms, which caused their airspeed indications to be lost. The autopilot and autothrust mechanisms disconnected as a result, and the pilots lost control of their plane. At nearly 35,000 feet, with both engines running at full speed, the flight plunged to the ocean below in only 3 minutes. 228 souls on board that night all sadly died. With more than 600 of this model of airplane being used around the world, it became an important task to find out what happened that fateful night. What caused one of the most technically advanced airplanes to crash? We will attempt to uncover the mystery that is Flight 447.
There were three pilots on board the flight that night. Captain Marc Dubois, aged 58, who had been flying aircraft since 1974. He had nearly 11,000 flying hours under his belt, which means basically he's a very experienced pilot.
What's the amount of hours that you need to be a pilot?
No idea.
I know he is very experienced anyway. Yeah. He's had he's literally been flying for...
So he's got 11,000 hours. First officer, David Robert, I will say.
David Robert.
The co-pilot. So he's 37. He'd be sat in the left seat. He had sort of 6,500 flying hours. Finally, the least experienced crew member, first officer, Pierre Cedric Bonin, I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the co-pilot. He's in the right seat. He was 32 at the time, and he had just under 3,000 flying hours. Which, again, you know, it's nowhere near as experienced as the other two, but he's not a novice. So Captain Marc Dubois, he was classed as PNF, so that stands for Pilot Not Flying, which essentially means he was not responsible for the flying of the aircraft on that flight. Instead, he would monitor the flight management and aircraft control actions of the PF, so the... Pilot flying, and carry out support duties such as communications and checklist reading. First Officer Pierre Cedric Bonin was classed as PF, pilot flying, so he's as it says, he's in charge of the flying the aircraft. Although he was the least experienced of the three pilots.
So the reason there was three pilots on board was to provide the pilots with breaks during the long flight, as it was 12 hours. In the cabin were 9 flight attendants and 216 passengers. The majority of passengers were French, Brazilian and German citizens, and there was some notable passengers as well. There was somebody who was third in succession to the abolished throne of Brazil, going by the name of Prince Pedro.
Oh, you know, if you've got an abolished... I mean, I've no idea.
I don't know how that
even works.
If
you've got an abolished throne of Brazil, how can you be third in succession to an abolished throne of Brazil? Mm. I don't know.
Not that notable, I guess.
No, I mean, I'm not. No.
So he was returning home from Luxembourg from a visit to his relatives in Rio de Janeiro. Mm. There was also a composer and former conductor of the symphony orchestras of... the Claudio Santoro National Theatre in Brazil.
Brasilia.
That's
the capital, isn't it, of Brazil, I believe.
Is it?
I think so, yeah. I think it was Rio de Janeiro, but I think it's Brasilia, isn't it?
So his name was Silvio Barbato.
Barbato.
And he was en route to, I don't know, but he was en route to Kiev for engagements there. And last but certainly not least, Pablo Dreyfus from Argentina. He was a campaigner for controlling illegal arms and the illegal drugs trade.
A good man then.
I know.
Sounds of it. So the flight took off from Rio de Janeiro at 20:29 hours local time. So half 8 in the evening, obviously. And at 20,000 feet, First Officer Robert left the cockpit for his 3-hour break. As Rachel just said, you know, it's a 12-hour flight.
I never got any 3-hour break on a 12-hour shift, did you? I know it's different when you're flying a plane, but it'd be nice.
I've had 12-hour shifts.
No break.
No break, never mind 3 hours. Oh. But obviously, yeah, and there's going to be very strict on these brakes, aren't they?
Definitely. Going to
be
recorded. Kind of like the
a
same
truck
thing,
driver,
exactly.
Isn't it?
You stole the words
coach
from my mouth.
Driver or
yeah,
whatever.
It'd be the exact same thing.
They have to, don't they? You can't. Mm. There's no even
it's
if
a way of going around
like
it.
If an employee wanted to, like a lot of employees do, wanted to work the nuts off you or him, they wouldn't be able to.
No.
Captain Dubois was in the left seat. First Officer Bonin. I'm saying it different every time. First Officer Bonin. He's the 32-year-old, the least experienced.
Yes.
He was to his right, as we've just said, he's the pilot flying, the PF. Mm-hmm. The flight continued to climb to its cruising altitude of 35,000 feet. Essentially, the plane was flying in an area between controllers and had failed to communicate with the DACA communication system at this point.
So basically what that means is you're flying your airplane, you have different controllers or different communication points that you hit. So there's, I think there was like four or five of them on their course. So they had logged off from one, which was like on the coast of Brazil, and they tried to log on to another. That was the Dakar one.
But there wasn't.
They couldn't log on to it for some reason. I don't know why. But basically what it means was they were in a point where there was no communication between these points. So it's kind of like a silent part of the course.
Right, so there's no... But would they be able to talk to someone, though, at the time?
They did with high frequency
voice. Oh, verbally,
voice.
They'd be able to speak, obviously, but they wouldn't...
And that's normal, though. Like, that's an expected thing as far
as
I could tell.
It's
just what it is.
I mean, the world's a big place, isn't it, I suppose?
The world is a big place.
I don't know whether this was over the sea.
Yeah.
So, and I guess over more densely, like if you were flying from, say, I don't know, Moscow to London...
Yeah, like obviously you're
you'd
going
you'd be covered
over.
All the way, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I presume.
Yeah. So, at 2:15 in the morning, the aircraft entered an area of weather and the crew discussed the possibility of climbing a further 20,000 feet to stay clear of the weather.
So if they went to... I mean, as you know, I'm interested in aircraft, but mainly military. I'm not expecting this. If they went up to 20,000 feet...
I don't think
so
that's
be 55,
possible to even go that high.
Is that not like the outer... It's kind of like a space.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can't do that. But they did discuss the possibility of it, according to my source.
Who's that?
Well, there's quite a few. Have a look in
the
show.
No, I'm joking.
So normally pilots would either fly over or around. I think they usually fly around because it's more risky to fly higher. And it wasn't classed as a particularly challenging flight. This was quite a normal thing to happen, especially on that course. It's normal to have those weather fronts. It's normal to have the lightning and all that kind of stuff because they're actually flying over the equator and there's a lot of weather that happens because obviously it's
a difference, isn't it?
I don't know what the science behind that is.
No,
I probably should look into it, but it is a known thing that there's a lot of weather fronts around that area.
And Captain Dubois, the 57-year-old who's got nearly 11,000 flying hours, flying, what was it, 35 years at this point, he was quite like a regular on this.
Yeah, absolute veteran. Like, had done it, like, so many times.
So trim,
for years and years and years, he'd flown this course. Amongst other ones, obviously. Mm. But, yeah. So, it wasn't particularly classed as being challenging or anything. And several other flights that evening did actually divert around this storm as well. So, they weren't just the only one who were obviously in that airspace.
And the weather thing as well. I presume that when this Captain Dubois, or the other two were pilots... When he'd been on this route many times before, I'm sure many times before he would have.
Yeah, definitely. You know. So, First Officer Bonin, that was the guy on the right who was in charge of flying the plane.
He's the youngest fellow in it.
Youngest.
Least experienced.
Yeah, because there's a lot of names in this and it's kind of hard to keep up with people, I think. So, he basically took the decision to dim the lights of the cabin.
I was going to say control.
And turn on the landing lights. And this was to ensure that basically they could see as best as possible when coming through the weather front. He actually exclaimed, in quotes, "It looks like we're entering the cloud cover. It would have been good to climb now, eh?"
So presumably at this point then, this contact with the, what was it called, DACA communications up and running?
No.
No, it's on the black box,
No, he's
isn't
speaking
it?
To...
On the high frequency radio.
Dubois in the cabin. This is what he's saying to his co-worker.
How do we know he said that?
Because black box.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
A few minutes later, the captain exclaimed, quote, "It's going to be turbulent for my rest." So Captain Dubois notices a phenomenon in the cockpit, St. Elmo's fire, and this is basically a lightning phenomenon caused by heavily discharged electricity, so it kind of lights up the sky. The flight continued, and the pilots prepared to fly through the weather front.
And again, they know that it's going to be, you know, rough, but how many times have you been on a flight where they say, you know...
Pretty much every flight I've ever been on has had turbulence.
And they're going over the equator, aren't they? And this whole St. Elmo's... Was that an 80s film, St. Elmo's Fire?
I think so, yeah.
Anyway, that's a different thing. But and again, they would have seen this before, wouldn't they? They wouldn't have been panicking, you know, it'd just be...
The two more experienced pilots were not panicking. I'm not sure about Bunnin. Feel like he didn't quite understand.
Because there's a documentary, isn't there, on... Yes. Is it on Netflix?
No, it's on YouTube, but it's called Chaos in the Cockpit.
And the younger fella...
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Bunnin,
yeah. You just said that. So he's the fella with the least experience.
Yeah.
On this documentary that's well worth watching, we watched it.
It is
yesterday.
Good, yeah.
They've got actors to do the...
Yeah.
But it sounds... But there is words from the black box.
Yeah, exactly.
And he does sound a bit kind of...
Well, he's just like, he didn't know about the St. Elmo's fire thing. You know, he'd never come across that before. He's just less experienced. I think that's, you know, that's all we can really say about it. He's just less experienced.
So at 2 a.m., so they're about, you know, what did it, took off at half eight. So they sort of.
Nearly halfway.
Halfway-ish. First Officer Robert returned from his break. Captain Dubois then left for his 3-hour break. It seems the first fatal mistake occurred here. It was Officer Dubois who was in charge of the flight, so he's the PF pilot flying. And as we've said, Bunnin had the least amount of experience, and he was essentially sat in the wrong seat.
What I mean by him sitting in the wrong seat is he should be in the left seat doing all the communication, all the background work, because he's the least experienced. When the main captain goes off on a break, Dubois, the 50-whatever-old...
When Dubois on the flight deck and he's not on his break, it's okay.
Well, probably. But what I'm trying to explain is that when he's gone, it should be the second in command, most experienced person should be in the right seat, because to the right of the right seat is the actual lever that they use to control the plane. So if they're not in autopilot... That needs to be, the person sitting in the right seat needs to be basically the one who is the pilot flying.
So from what information we've gleaned, it should be the chap that, so...
So Robert, it should be him who Robert was flying the plane.
And then...
And Bunnin, who was doing the communications. But for whatever reason, they decided between themselves that Bunnin would fly the plane, basically.
Yeah. So it was also strange that Captain Dubois went for his 3 hours at this busy time in the flight. But then again... Hindsight's a wonderful thing. Again, you know, he's very experienced. You know, we've not seen his flight log. He's probably been in that exact same situation numerous
times
before.
Yeah.
And he's thinking, like, well, if I don't get my break now, I'm not going to get my break. And,
yeah.
You know, but obviously...
It's easy to say these things.
It is, but it's, you know, a decision that all three pilots would soon regret, unfortunately. 6 minutes later, the two first officers informed the crew that there will be turbulence ahead in about 2 minutes' time. The flight then encountered an updraft and a sound which would be typical of ice crystals hitting the fuselage was heard.
I love that word, fuselage.
Okay, just say it. Fuselage.
Fuselage.
Anyway. Gonna be all day. The cruising speed was reduced by Bunnin as per guidelines. This automatically reduced the engine speed from 100% to 84%. Due to the ice crystals then encountered, the pitot tubes... So they measure airspeed. They clogged in the left-hand side. They're kind of tubes, aren't they, that come...
They're little tubes that basically the air goes into them and it measures the airspeed. Measures the air hitting.
They're little tubes that kind of hang down from the...
Well, they don't really... I don't think they hang down. I think they're kind of... They're straight like that, so that when the air comes into them, it measures it.
What is that? Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Literally mean... Yeah. But they do obviously... Yeah. Yeah, the left sign indicated that the airspeed had reduced from 275 knots to 60 knots incorrectly. So obviously 60 knots, there'd be massive dangerous stalling here.
Yeah, and the thing is, actually, there was nothing wrong with the plane other than this was incorrect.
Yeah, the tube.
Yeah, I mean, they had, you know, they were still on the same airspeed. Mm. They hadn't changed altitudes or anything. It was just a, you know, an error in the instrumentation.
Yeah. So the autopilot also disconnected, which was as per policy to allow the pilots to take back control. Because the autopilot's thinking, well, we haven't got the correct information here to fly this plane.
We need a human to do it for us, basically.
Yeah, we need to... Yeah. Because a lot of, you know, apart from taking off, landing, and taking action, it's on autopilot, isn't it?
Yeah.
When they're flying, they put the course in, don't they?
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
You know, rather than, like, flying a bomber in the Second World War, where literally the pilot for 10 hours over Berlin or something, he's got to pilot it for 10 hours.
Yeah, a lot of it is automated.
Yeah, yeah. So the autopilot's disconnected. It's gone back to the pilots to take control. So it's a safety mechanism, basically.
Yeah.
Due to the tubes being clogged, and therefore indications being incorrect, internal altimeter corrections were automatically recalculated as if the plane was flying at a lower speed than it actually was. So this resulted in false readings regarding the altitude.
Yeah.
Essentially, the pilots should have done nothing and realised the airspeed was incorrect. Bonin was inexperienced and panicked. We will never know why he responded in the way he did. So he's thinking at this time...
He's basically taking it for face value.
Yeah, so he's thinking, I need to increase speed.
I need to go higher and increase my speed. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So Bonin began hand-flying the plane. He reported, quote, I have the controls. Bonin struggled to regain control over the plane. Attempts were made to call the captain back at 2:10 a.m. as he was on break. The stall warning also began to sound. Robert said, quote, but we've got the engines. What's happening? The flight began to descend regardless of pilot input and started to pull consistently to the right. So Bonin pulled back on the control stick, which caused the aircraft to climb. The aircraft instruments showed a loss of altitude, which were all false readings, as we've already said. Bonin decided to trust the instrument's readings, however. Climbing at 7,000 feet a minute, going to very thin air, the aircraft started slowing down. Another alarm, stall warning, commenced, as the aircraft was going too slow. This happens when the aircraft is climbing too fast, too high. It essentially stalls, just like a car would if you pushed it, you know, quickly up a hill.
Climbing too high, too fast.
Too high, too fast.
Yeah.
So to prevent the plane from falling, Bonin needed to act quickly. He should have pushed forward on the side stick, get that speed back up and putting the nose down and going downhill. But in fact, he doesn't do this. He continues to climb and literally does the exact opposite of what he needed to do.
Hmm.
So one of three speed sensors started working here again, but they didn't believe the reading due to all the other false readings. So it was just all really confusing and really panicky. And as the documentary says, just chaos in the cockpit. And quite chillingly, Bonin announced at 2:11 a.m., quote, I don't have control of the airplane anymore now. I don't have control of the airplane at all. The descent increased to 10,000 feet per minute. Eventually, the Captain Dubois entered the cockpit again from his break. The captain asked, what are you doing? The airplane continued to descend. A proper handover and explanation of what had happened since the storm was not even given to Captain Dubois. And this was a really crucial time, actually, because he was a set of fresh eyes, wasn't he? He could have come back, and if he had the right information, he probably would have been able to have troubleshooted it and realised what was happening.
Yeah, with his experience he's got as well.
Yes, definitely. But because of the poor communication, they didn't give him that handover of all the events that had happened so far.
So what's actually happening now then, Rachel? Just explain where the plane's...
So basically, the plane is falling
because
Bonin has his hand on the control system and he's trying to put the plane too high. Does that make sense? He's pushing the plane too high and too fast at the same time, which is causing the plane to stall, which is actually causing the plane to fall.
Because the airspeed is, obviously, if he's stalling, the airspeed's massively reducing, isn't it? But his instruments are still saying...
He's believing his instruments, which are saying he's falling and that he's at a different altitude than he actually is. Oh.
Well, that's Noah there. Just added his...
So it's really confusing because obviously there's a lot of technical information, but basically he's doing the exact opposite of what he needed to do.
And why do we think he's...
He didn't understand the situation. It was just inexperience.
But is that not a bit? I mean, I'm not being critical of, you know. Well, I mean, only because I don't. But surely. No, go on. What you say?
What I'm going to say is it's inexperience, but it's also there's a lack of training, which we will come on to as well.
Mm.
Because think about it, these pilots, a lot of the newer pilots especially, they've only ever really flown planes with a lot of automated stuff going on. So they're not used to actually.
Whereas Dubois, I mean,
he probably has more experience 70s. of well, doing that. Yeah, one would presume.
Okay, so by 2:12 a.m., they're descended through 10,000 feet. So they're going down, basically.
They're going down.
First Officer Robert responded to Captain Dubois by saying, "We've lost all control of the aeroplane. We don't understand anything. We've tried everything." Soon after this, Robert said to himself, "Climb," four times. Bonin heard this and replied, "But I've been at maximum nose up for a while." When Captain Dubois heard this, he realised Bonin was causing the stall and shouted, "No, no, no, don't climb. No, no, no."
This is interesting because he kind of realises what's going on here.
Yeah.
But it's not clear. Like, he didn't communicate it clearly enough. And also, no one's listening to him. It's really strange. They're all panicking. No one's communicating clearly. And for that reason, nothing happens.
When First Officer Robert heard this, he told Bonin to give the control of the aeroplane to him. In response to this, Bonin would temporarily give the controls to Robert. The main issue here was the communication between Robert and Bonin. Bonin still had control of the control stick to his right side. However, Robert was unaware of this and could not see it as it was to Bonin's right side, hidden away. Bonin should have relinquished full control of the plane to Robert, but essentially panicked and kept control despite Robert asking him to do so, asking him to give the control to him.
Yeah.
Robert pushed his side stick forward to try to regain lift for the airplane to climb out of the stall. However, the aircraft was now too low to recover from the stall. Shortly thereafter, the ground proximity warning system sounded an alarm, warning the crew about the aircraft's now imminent crash into the ocean.
So that's the one that's like, pull up,
yeah,
pull
yeah.
up.
We've
all heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, on a
not
phone.
In a flight, yeah. but yeah.
Thank God. In response, Bonin, without informing his colleagues, pulled his side stick all the way back again and, realising the situation was now hopeless, said, "We're going to crash. This can't be true. But what's happening?" The flight data recording stopped at 2:14 and 28 seconds a.m. or 3 hours 45 minutes after takeoff. All 228 passengers and crew died as a result of trauma due to the impact. Attempts were made to contact the aircraft, which were unsuccessful. Therefore, initially, an aerial search was conducted to try and locate the aircraft. This was conducted by the Brazilian Air Force, by their maritime patrol aircraft.
Do you know that aircraft, CASA 235?
No.
Because you're kind of into...
Yeah, but as well as the US Navy Lockheed Martin P-3 Orion anti-submarine warfare maritime patrol aircraft.
What a mouthful.
I know. Wreckage was found 2 days later, and subsequently on the 6th of June, bodies began to surface from the wreckage. The search continued for the Airbus's black box and flight data recorder. The missing black box would solve the mystery. A French nuclear sub was deployed to help with the search. It would be able to pick up ultrasonic beacons that the black box emits.
Mm-hmm.
There was 30 days to find it, then the battery dies. Oh, I didn't realise that.
Did you not realise that?
No, I thought it lasted longer
than that. It's only every 30 days, and then basically the ultrasonic whatever beacons, they stop, and then you're kind of screwed because you just actually have to physically look for it then.
Yeah. 30 days pass without any success, so they don't find it, and the search effort up to that point was up to £25 million it cost.
A lot of money. But then again, when you look at how many of the aircrafts were already out there, they needed to find it. So,
because
if there's something really wrong, then that could happen again. 600 aircraft in the world.
Definitely, yeah.
So it wasn't until 2 years later that the black box would actually be located. It was the same team that actually located the Titanic that found the shattered fuselage, initially 13,000 feet down. They also found 104 bodies still strapped in their seats.
Jesus.
And then they successfully located the black box. So basically, there is 74 bodies that are still missing to this day, actually, which is quite horrible.
They're
and many bodies.
Never gonna be found over now.
Yeah. And the black box recordings show the precise sequence of events. So the final terrifying minutes leading up to the crash. So this was obviously a massive find for them and, you know, really uncover the mystery of actually what happened. So there was an investigation from the BEA, and there was lots of different factors going on. So there was technical and human factors, and also the Pitot failure, which was measuring the airspeed, but it wasn't actually the first time that this had happened. It had actually been recorded before on different aircraft.
On different aircraft, so Airbuses?
I'm not sure.
Well, on other aircraft, that's what we need to know, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, it had not been reported that some crews had actually difficulty in understanding these situations when there was a pit-up failure as well. So they were going to look at actually phasing in better instruments, but this had not happened to a full degree. So I think they had some of the Airbuses that had the new pit-ups, but a lot didn't. So this was kind of in process at the time. But when they looked at the safety requirements, the older Pitots did actually meet the safety requirements. So it's kind of a weird one, really. They did actually retest after the accident and they still met the requirements. However, since August 2009, all the new Pitots have actually been replaced, which is good to know. And they have looked at stall alarms and instrumentation improvements as well, because they did say that the flight director was quite confusing in that specific situation. And they wanted to obviously make that less confusing. So Airbus says pilots ignored some of the operational policies and should have turned off the flight director at this point as well. Obviously, I can't comment on that because, it's a very kind of technical thing. But the investigation did recommend additional training for pilots. So pilots, you know, they're using a lot of these automatics and they might actually lose a lot of their manual flying skills as time goes on, because things just become more and more automatic, don't they? So since then, the Air France themselves have actually introduced more training as well as regards these specific incidences which pilots can be faced with. So in March 2011, a French judge filed preliminary manslaughter charges against Air France and Airbus over this crash. On the 5th of July 2012, the BEA released its final report on the accident, and there was loads of different preliminary reports as well. The accident resulted from the following succession of major events. So, temporary inconsistency between the measured speeds, likely as a result of the obstruction of the pitot tube. So we've already spoken about that. The crew made inappropriate control inputs that destabilised the flight path. The crew failed to follow appropriate procedure for the loss of airspeed information. The crew were late in identifying and correcting the deviation from the flight path. The crew lacked understanding of the approach to stall, and the crew failed to recognise the aircraft had stalled and consequently did not make inputs that would make it possible to recover from the stall. So we've talked about the airplane stall a lot. I think we've already explained what it is, but just to remind you, an airplane stall, it's basically an aerodynamic condition in which an aircraft exceeds its given critical angle of attack and is no longer able to produce the required lift for a normal flight. So basically, it's falling through the midair because it can't maintain itself.
Yeah.
The two co-pilots' task sharing was weakened both by the incomprehension of the situation at the time, but also by poor management of the startle effect, so that it kind of leave them very emotionally challenged, you know,
Which you can understand, can't you?
Yeah, it's an emotionally charged situation, but their job, they have that job to remain calm in that situation. That's literally their job to do that.
You know
what I mean? Because it's autopilot all the way until something goes wrong, isn't it? And it's when something goes wrong that actually they are the ones that need to recognize what's happening, take charge and remedy the situation.
Because the autopilot can't then, can it?
Yes.
As we saw with this.
So they didn't do that. And that's not just a human failure. I do think that's like more of a systemic failure of lack of training. Again, looking at training, especially in regards to manual, flying and
that kind
of thing.
Well, there's kind of three things that we spoke about. There's, they didn't follow policy to a point or the whatever, the manual or whatever. The startle effect.
Yeah.
And then,
but they didn't recognise the issue to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. That's, well, they didn't recognise issues to begin with. They didn't follow kind of policy.
The communication policy as well between them.
Yeah, the communication, the startle effect, and also error with the airspeed indicator, the airspeed.
Yeah, well, that's a major factor. Yeah. But I also think the fact that Bonin literally kept charge of the flight even though he was told not to anymore.
Why is he doing that?
He panicked. He believed the indicators.
So he's
so they're pushing down, and he's going, "What the fuck are you doing? We need to go higher."
So the kind of one's doing one.
Yeah, literally, and you know that is. You just can't even. There's no excuse for that, is there? Really?
No, it's gone to shit, hasn't it?
It went to shit, lads.
Shortly after the crash, Air France changed the number of the regular Rio de Janeiro to Paris flight from AF447, which it was, to AF445. I don't know whether... I suppose they're going to change.
I think I'll stay clear of that flight, to be honest.
Well, the next time we're flying from Rio to...
Next time we're in Rio.
And need to go to Paris.
Yeah.
So, but... That route, Air France still uses Airbus A330-200s.
I mean, pitot tubes.
Yes, yeah, just for anyone who's going
and more training.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, Airbus, Air France, they're going to have a big contract. They're made in Toulouse, aren't they? Airbus, that's where the...
I didn't know that.
That's where the, the French company. Air France and Airbus have been investigated for manslaughter since 2011. But in 2019, prosecutors recommended dropping the case against Airbus and charging Air France with manslaughter and negligence, concluding, in quotes, the airline was aware of technical problems with a key airspeed monitoring instrument on its plane, so the pitot tube, but failed to train pilots to resolve them, end quotes. The case against Airbus was dropped on 22nd of July the same year. The case against Air France was dropped in September 2019, so... 6 months or so ago, when magistrates said there was not enough grounds to prosecute.
It's really interesting, though.
It was a real
challenge to research this, because obviously there was so much technical stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not a pilot. I don't know what that means. So there was a lot of Googling terms and trying to figure things out.
And we're doing a podcast, aren't we? So it's, do you know what I mean? It's, you know, so we haven't got charts and things we can show. So
no, I don't have any charts.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has been difficult. And there's probably a couple of mistakes in here of you know, technical things. So if there's any pilots or engineers or mechanics, please don't judge us. I'm not a freaking pilot.
Yeah,
but it has been really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we've done it on a level, haven't we? And it is a different thing for mad or bad, isn't it?
It is definitely. Cause it's
and we're
kind
not
of
saying the pilot or any of the crew are
mad or bad. It was just something different to do. I might actually do another one at some point. I do have a strange fascination with aircraft investigations. When I was working a long time ago in a nursing home, I used to work like the early kind of morning shift till the afternoon. And my thing was always to come home and it would be about like 2-3 o'clock. I used to literally sit there, watch aircraft investigation, then fall asleep and have a nap. After my cup of tea and my cheese and ham sandwich.
Your macaroon.
I am one for...
Routine.
Yeah.
So,
I do love that.
Safe journey for anyone that's going on to Paris to...
I don't think anyone will be going anywhere with this bloody coronavirus. Especially not Paris or Italy.
No, they won't be at the moment, will they?
When this comes out, though, it's going to be May, and I wonder what things are going to be like then. That'll be really interesting.
Well, Rachel's sister's,
meant to be coming over from America, but I don't think it's going
to
happen. That's supposed to be in May.
So I think that's gone to shit, hasn't it?
Probably.
And your mum and dad meant to be coming from Ireland.
That's but, you know, to shit as well, you just keep people safe, don't we, more than anything. That's the most important thing.
Anyway.
So yeah, that's it for this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Hope we didn't annoy you too much.
Goodbye.
Bye. As always, catch us on facebook.com/madorbad. You can catch us on Twitter. Our handle is @madorbadthepod. And also, we now have a Patreon account. So please go look us up. It is patreon.com/madorbad. You can access exclusive content. We have exclusive episodes only available to Patreon supporters. So go find us.